I'm Marlena Smith. It looks like it's 3 minutes after the hour of 9. You are tuned to the community radio station that you make possible. This is the Electronic Salon. First show of the season. Want to let you know this program has been made possible in part by Kibu Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories, which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com. I have a guest on the line, Joe Connison.
Good morning.
How you doing, Joe?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm good. Marlena Smith here, Joe. Nice to have you on the air with us. Thanks for taking the time.
It's my pleasure.
Okay. Well, let me tell people a little bit about you in case they just haven't been tuning in. You're an investigative reporter. You've written for the Village Voice. You've covered three presidential campaigns, the Iran-Contra scandal, which is quite familiar to my listeners, the Tiananmen Square incident in Beijing. In 1980, you won a New York Press Club Byline Award. 1985, your investigative reporting about the hidden American assets of Philippine dictator Ferdinand Marcos led to congressional hearings. In the year 2000, you worked with Gene Lyons, a former general editor at Newsweek and author of several books himself. The two of you collaborated on the hunting of a president, the 10-year campaign to destroy Bill and Hillary Clinton. In 2003, you authored Big Lies, a book dealing with the right-wing propaganda machine and how it distorts the truth. You have been a national correspondent for the New York Observer. You also write a daily online journal for Salon.com, and your work frequently appears in Harper's, The Guardian, The Nation, and The New Republic. You are a regular contributor to TV and radio, and you're currently featured on Air America's Al Franken Show every Friday, so we're pretty honored to get you just before Al. And your newest book is dealing with Social Security. Joe Connison, it's nice to introduce you to the listeners of KBOO, and it's a pleasure to welcome you to this radio station. So,
thank you very much. I only have to correct one thing which is that I don't write the daily journal for Salon anymore. I write a weekly column for them, but I'm still on Salon.com every week. So.
Well, Joe, and the other thing I didn't have information about was your new book about Social Security.
Yes, it is out, actually. I bought a copy at the Looking Glass bookstore in downtown Portland last night myself.
Okay.
It's called The Raw Deal, How the Bush Republicans Plan to Destroy Social Security and the Legacy of the New Deal. It has a foreword by Al Franken and a preface by Franklin Delano Roosevelt's grandson, James Roosevelt, Jr., who was an assistant commissioner of Social Security in the Clinton administration. And it's a book about the ongoing effort by the Republican right to dismantle the Social Security system and turn it over to the private sector, which has been going on for many years but has kind of reached a crescendo in the last 5 years under George W. Bush and especially since last year's election. And this book tells the story of those efforts and particularly where it is coming from, the ideology behind it, and why they're trying to do this. Mm-hmm. Now, as your listeners probably know, so far that effort has been frustrated, mostly because the American people have rejected it by almost a two-thirds majority in polls that we've seen since last spring when the president went out and started to promote this idea. But that doesn't mean they're going to give up. And it's also important for people to understand where this is coming from because many of the problems we face in this country now stem from an ideology of dismantling government that has led us, for example, to the problem we have in the Gulf Coast now, where essentially the same ideologues who believe in dismantling Social Security at the Cato Institute, which is an important think tank in Washington, also think that we should have abolished FEMA and abolished the Army Corps of Engineers and basically leave people to exist in a state of nature when there's a disaster. And it's very, very important for people to kind of understand the kind of threat that this ideology in practice poses to our safety and security.
Joe, the whole concept of dismantling government, what does that leave us with?
Well, as I said, I think it leaves us in the state of nature. It leaves us with
I'm thinking the corporate takeover.
Well, yes. I mean, it leaves you it's sort of the survival of the fittest, which means those who have the most wealth and power. And it leaves the rest of us pretty much at their mercy. For example, let's say there was no regulation of insurance companies, which is something that I'm sure these ideologues would also pretty much agree with. If there's no regulation, then you buy an insurance company insurance policy to save your home, and when it's washed away by you know, a hurricane, you can't collect because the insurance company doesn't will tell you that, you know, your home wasn't covered, and you know they don't have to do anything about it, and the government's not going to protect you. It means that in the face of a natural disaster like this, there would be no agency of national authority to try to do anything to save people. And so, you know, try to imagine what it would have been like if every hurricane had the kind of response to it that this government has managed. The kind of failure in every hurricane, we'd be a devastated country.
In a sense, this hurricane may in fact have been a harbinger of where we are now heading.
Well, it is a harbinger of where we're heading if this ideology continues to hold sway over the government, because they are dismantling. I mean, basically what they've treated FEMA as is an employment agency for their friends.
Excellent point.
The you know, with no real function. I mean, if you don't care whether FEMA can do its job, then you put someone like Michael Brown in charge of it, who it turns out today doesn't even have a real law degree. I mean, this guy is a complete, I mean, he should be, I don't know what he should be doing, but the idea that he was put in charge of one of the most important agencies of the federal government is insane. But the only way you could do that is if you really didn't care whether these federal functions were carried out or not.
It seems to me, in watching the events of the past week or so, your book, Big Lies, which is your prior book, was probably pretty prescient with regard to what's happening in both of the Gulfs, the Gulf crisis in Iraq as well as the coastal Gulf in the United States. And one of the things that occurs to me is that three scenarios are playing out in my mind. One is just gross incompetence, inability to coordinate because of stupid choices, amongst leadership people and failure to actually do their jobs, which is, you know, kind of the bungling one. A second one is that there was an intentional, inherent institutional racism involved in this episode, because every time you looked on the TV, you saw poor people who were people of color for the most part. And then the third thing is just the basic dismantling of a sector, as Randy Rhodes calls it, level the whole area, sell the land for cheap, and then bring in the condos and the casinos for the big developers. Any one of those or all of those are possible at one time, which means that Democrats and we, the people, have to really jump up and do something really important and do it really quickly, because we've got Supreme Court nominees coming down the pike. Karen Hughes is back in the home nest. These boys are ready to keep rolling. And even your Social Security point is an important part of this. These guys still plan to go ahead with this, and that's part of the point of that book, right?
Oh, yes. They certainly want to go ahead with this. And I think, in fact, even in the wake of the hurricane,
exactly,
there will be, either at the end of this month or next month, a bill introduced in the House that would be a move towards Social Security privatization.
Mm-hmm.
The question is whether they could pass that kind of bill in the Senate, and most people don't think they can. But the reason for that is that people really mobilized against this idea over the past year. There have been a lot of organizations, labor movement, Campaign for America's Future, the American Association of Retired Persons have built a movement to stop Social Security privatization that's been quite powerful, and that has created an unease, let's say, in the minds of Republican senators about whether they want to go ahead with this, particularly the ones who may be facing re-election next year. So all of this is going to revolve around next year's midterm elections, which are going to be a critical, critical election in this country's history, because it will be a question of whether, in spite of all the failures and disasters that have come about as a result of this administration, this Congress, and their ideology, whether there's any accountability for that. And I think we'll find that out a year from November.
I want to remind our listeners, you are Joe Connison, author of The Hunting of the President, Big Lies, and most recently a book titled The Raw Deal about Social Security. it seems as though they're going to just bulldoze ahead, Joe, and do whatever it is that they want to do, whether it's Social Security, nominating the Supreme Court Justice and the associate, continuing with their agenda, and they've fronted all of their women and mommy and daddy and all of those people, in Mr. Bush's case, to let the public know that they don't want him to be criticized because it hurts his feelings. And we're getting that kind of touchy-feely piece on it.
They don't want the blame game. They all repeat the same phrase over and over again. We can't play the blame game, which, of course, means you can't hold us accountable.
Mm-hmm.
We want power. We want wealth. We want power. We want absolute power if we can get it. But don't try to hold us accountable when we fail. And that's, you know, of course, in a democratic society, that's unacceptable.
Well, you talked about the elections in 2006, which are certainly important, and Democrats would do well to capture the House. But here's the problem. We have these black box voting problems.
You do have black box voting problems, but that doesn't mean that no Democrat can win an election anymore.
Right.
If taken to its logical conclusion, that would mean that, you know, they would rig every election in the country, and of course that's not happening. So, you know, obviously we need to be vigilant. The black box voting is kind of a chicken and egg issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, can you elect enough Democrats that you will have effective oversight over the voting systems, which we don't have from the House anymore because they are perfectly happy to see whatever go on that benefits them? Or, you know, does the reform of the black box voting have to come first before you can elect enough Democrats to have effective rates? So it's a circular problem. I think people just have to go out and work very hard and monitor their local election districts very carefully. You know, we've had some indictments of people in Ohio now for election abuses. So it's far from a hopeless situation.
Do you think the Gulf War or the Gulf Coast strategy, and that's how I'm thinking of it in my own mind, and the pulling of military and National Guard people may inadvertently or actually overtly be an exit strategy from the other Gulf?
I don't think it would be a conscious strategy. I think this was an act of nature and not something that they could have really planned on. I think it exposes how badly planned this entire venture has been in Iraq. From the beginning, military experts, including the highest-ranking figures in the Pentagon, warned the president that they did not have enough troops to enforce real security and order in Iraq after the invasion and the overthrow of Saddam, that they would need probably twice as many troops as they were putting on the ground there, and that we simply didn't have, the army was not prepared to do that. This has led to the depletion of the National Guard and the additional pressures that we felt now in the face of this disaster. They've been warned about all of these things over and over again, and one of the hallmarks of these ideologues is their arrogance. They actually don't respect people in government who know what they're talking about. The State Department told them what they needed to do in Iraq in order to try to preserve Iraqi society in some form after the invasion. They ignored that. Lengthy reports, documentation, the same thing with this hurricane disaster. In 2001, FEMA experts told them, people lower down in the bureaucracy than Michael Brown and the other bozos that they put in charge of the agency, political appointees, but people studied this and they told them three disasters could occur in the United States. This is just before 9/11. A terrorist strike in New York City, an earthquake in San Francisco, in California, and a hurricane, a four or five hurricane hitting the Gulf Coast and especially New Orleans. They ignored this and went about cutting the budget for the Army Corps of Engineers to shore up the levees and didn't do the necessary planning that would have made a disaster relief and management possible there, because they either don't care or they have no interest in the expertise that exists in the government. It's been built up over many, many years, whether it's in the Pentagon, the State Department, FEMA, or many other agencies. They completely ignore this. And this is, again, the ideology of dismantling government.
Well,
and it's very dangerous.
Either that or somebody had a plan somewhere that it would be a lot more cost-effective and good for the good old boy club to destroy that town and make it a high-rise.
Well, until I see that, the evidence of that,
gotcha.
I work on these sort of Occam's razor method, which is, you know, the facts before you. The simplest explanation is usually the right one. In the face of the facts that we see now and our experience with this government, I think they're a bunch of incompetent fools.
Well, I couldn't agree more with that. You know, one of the things that occurred to me in your book, Big Lies, you have a little section here about Trent Lott and his commentary about Strom Thurmond. Remember that piece at the press conference where he sort of where he blurted out something about Strom Thurmond?
He said, if only Strom Thurmond had been elected president in 1948 running on the segregation ticket, the whole country would be a lot better off now.
Mm-hmm.
And we wouldn't have had these problems we've been having since 1948. And, of course, he was removed from the Senate leadership because of that remark.
Well, that piece kind of stayed in my mind when I was thinking about the president's remark about Trent Lott's house and how it was going to be rebuilt and he was going to sit on the porch and enjoy it. And it was almost one of the more offensive things that he said in that whole episode. And he almost, he was sort of out of it when he said it. He looked like he had that deer in the headlights look. But I thought to myself, there's a kind of an institutional link there of racism. Here's Trent Lott, who aligns himself with Strom Thurmond's racism, and here's the president saying, I'm going to go sit on his porch. And he's saying it in the middle of a place where there are people who are dying and
sit on his porch and drink mint juleps.
Right, and being held at checkpoint from leaving a flooded city, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, if you wanted to make a case, it seems to me there's enough evidence now, both structural and on the ground, if you wanted to make a case that this was a form of negligent or premeditated homicide, I'm sure somebody could do that. But on the other hand, just looking at it from a straightforward shot, these were good old boys, and it looked like there's a lot of racism in that crowd just in general. And that, those kind of links, Trent Lott, Strom Thurmond, George Bush, just made me really scratch my head and wonder what they were thinking.
Well, you know, that the president would see as the first priority to rebuild the house of a fairly wealthy senator who has other residences and is not really in any danger of being homeless as certainly a commentary on his character. I agree with that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, you know, what was interesting about the aftermath of the hurricane was that it sort of peeled away, some of what disguises structural racism in the society. I mean, you know, we and the rest of the world, by the way, got another good look at the underclass in America, which has been suffering more in the last 5 years than it did in the 8 years before. 8 years, you know, under a Democratic administration, there was some amelioration of poverty. People were beginning to climb out of poverty because the economy was good and there were things that were done to try to help people. We've had the opposite of that for the last 5 years, and people are falling back into poverty. And in places like New Orleans, we got a look at, you know, where the bottom, the very bottom, and of course it's mostly black people.
Well, this comes back again to both your book Big Lies and your book, the new book, The Raw Deal, about Social Security. Here we have the most devastated probably among us in the country. Here are questions about whether or not the rest of us are going to even have Social Security, and here are people who that's not even an issue right now. But one of the other pieces that's coming down the economic pike is the new bankruptcy reform laws, which are supposed to take effect on the 17th. It's my understanding that Bill Frist, the Senate Majority Leader, has held up the repeal of the estate tax because it so benefits the wealthy. It's also my understanding that this bankruptcy bill is going to allow, give permission to corporations to tap their pensions for losses they experienced in the Gulf. So here we have yet other conduits of theft going on, and I know the Democrats are sponsoring legislation to try to halt this process,
right.
But isn't this just kind of more of the same?
Of course.
Stealing
of course.
From the poor?
No. Almost everything that is being done by this Congress is intended to channel funds from the poor working class and middle class Americans to the super rich. That is their overriding goal, and it's amazing how single-minded they are about it. Whether they postpone a vote on the estate tax or not, I think if they do, it's because the Democrats have held very firm in saying, we're not going to do this now, and they don't want to embarrass themselves as we go into an election year. But they will return to that, just as they will return to privatizing Social Security. Why? Because privatizing Social Security would provide the largest windfall to the financial industry in human history. I mean, it would be the biggest. It's close to $1 trillion. that in profits that they would realize over a 75-year period. And that's an awful lot of money, and it is a tremendous attraction for them. So almost everything they do is aimed towards those goals. Meanwhile, of course, they came in and they decided, well, we have disaster relief costs, which are going to be in the tens of billions. So how can we pay for that? Well, we'll cut existing welfare benefits. We'll cut food stamps. We'll cut student loans. You know, we'll cut education aid. All the things that benefit poor and working class people, they're going to take that money away from those programs, which, by the way, the disaster victims all will need very soon anyway, and use that for the disaster relief. And at the same time, they wanted to do the estate tax repeal, which would have, again, put billions of dollars into the pockets of the wealthiest people. So, yes, their priorities are exactly upside down.
Well, now, see, here's the dilemma I have. I listen to what you're saying, and I'm thinking along the same lines that here they are stripping everything from those at the bottom, the most needy. Is that just bungling, or is that a premeditated form?
Oh, no, that's premeditated. There's no question.
That's their
ideology.
Is that ethnic cleansing? Are we looking at genocide in our own country?
Well, you know, I'm not sure I would use that term because, of course, many poor people are white too. I mean, they don't discriminate in that way. They're happy to make white people miserable too if they're at the bottom of the ladder, or Hispanics. I mean, this is not. They're equal opportunity oppressors, you could say.
Okay, just maybe genocide would be the simplest way. What about the, let's see, what else is going on with these guys? If we look at the Supreme Court situation right now, one of the concerns I have is here we have this very corrupt administration that's incompetent and bungling and all of the other things that we can say. Is there any way that this is going to be held back, or is Roberts going to end up being the Chief Justice and perhaps Gonzalez the associate?
I'm not ready to make a prediction about that yet. I think, I think Roberts has a good chance of being approved as the Chief Justice, but there are signs of resistance to his nomination, and I think we'll have to see where that goes. The problem that the president has right now is that his approval ratings are in the, you know, sort of, they're down there in the sewage with the city of New Orleans. His approval ratings are among the lowest in modern history for any president, and therefore, his ability to force votes on any issue has greatly diminished as we near a midterm election, because all the members of Congress are more and more concerned about their association with him as they prepare to face voters.
Do we have any evidence yet or any information yet from the polls in the aftermath of what happened in the Gulf Coast?
Well, I saw a couple of polls yesterday as I was getting ready to come out to Portland. And they were both very unfavorable to the president. One was a CBS News poll, which showed 28% approval of his performance in the aftermath of Katrina and 58% disapproval.
Yeah, I'm thinking he's down in the 20s probably by now.
Well, I don't know if his general approval rating is that low. I think it's probably somewhere between 35 and 42, but that's extremely low.
Not good.
That's getting down to sort of the hardcore of his base, and that's a big problem for him and his party.
Joe Connison is the guest. Joe, another question that has been on my mind is the media seems to have awakened both print and electronic. Instead of just kind of being, pals with the president and the White House and just kind of doing everything they saying good things about everything they do or not being critical, in the last couple of weeks, watching what's been happening in the Gulf Coast, there's been a huge amount of outrage and criticism. Part of me thinks it's because they had their own people on the ground who were seeing firsthand what was happening and were also exposed to the danger. But something seems to have happened, and I'm wondering if you're getting that same feeling.
I certainly am. I happened to be on vacation a couple of weeks ago in the East, and I ran into somebody I won't identify by name, but a top sort of shouting head on TV who has been quite supportive of Bush over the last several years, and he came up to me and said, you've been proved right by this. You and the other critics of Bush have been proved right by this experience, and everybody in the media is outraged. They are outraged, except for the really hardcore flacks and apologists for the White House. The other folks in the mainstream media who have, you know, as you put it, very mixed records on their journalism regarding this administration, have finally seen what this is about, finally seen how incompetent, how arrogant this administration is, and the truth is, the whole country has been humiliated by this in the eyes of the world. The entire country has, and people at these news organizations know this, and they're angry about it.
It's interesting also, I mean, I'm thinking to myself, we have the Democratic Congressional Caucus, which is always out on the edge pushing for all the right things. We now have the media starting to awaken. We have a lot of Democrats in Congress. Nancy Pelosi's coming out. We have Hillary Clinton calling for separating FEMA, creating criteria for the FEMA position so that we wouldn't have some lackey. And by the way, have you noticed they're starting to go after Time Magazine for criticizing Michael Brown?
Well, Time Magazine has exposed how hollow this guy's record is and what a sham it is that he was appointed to head FEMA.
And did you see what the White House is responding with?
I heard that this morning on CNN, I heard that they weren't responding. Have they had a response now?
Last night when I got home from work, I saw a piece, I think it was CNN, or maybe it was MSNBC, you know, you start cruising all those stations. But the line that was being read from the White House was that this was unconfirmed material and it wasn't right for Time Magazine to use this unconfirmed information.
Uh-huh.
And that was the line that they were putting out.
Well, here's my answer to that. Let's have an independent investigation of this. let's have an independent commission that investigates this response. Not an investigation led by the president, as he said he wanted to do the other day. But let's have an independent investigation, then we'll find out the confirmed information about Michael Brown, which is not going to make them look any better. So, yes, absolutely. Let's confirm all the information about him.
It's so sleazy, Joe. I mean, it just makes me feel creepy listening to these guys now.
It is.
After everything we've seen in the last 2 weeks, Mr. Bush was on this morning talking about Karen Hughes, and I just felt this revulsion, and I don't usually get that way because I'm used to these sleazy people. But he just really, there's something really awkward now about even looking at him.
The emperor has no clothes,
yes, thank
Marlena,
you.
That's pretty hard to look at.
Yeah,
I'm going to have to go in a few
like
minutes, I'm sorry to say.
Okay, I understand
but,
totally. I'm going to thank you.
I would like to mention that I'm going to be speaking tonight at the First Unitarian Church at 7 o'clock, which is at 1011 Southwest 12th and Main Street.
7 o'clock?
7 o'clock, First Unitarian Church, and there will be books there.
Is there a donation there, Joe? Or is that a free?
You know, I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, so
but people can call a number and find out. It's 503-238-7683.
Okay, and we'll make sure that our listeners know that.
Thank you very much.
I want to thank you for being with us, and please say hello to your friend Al, who was a guest here a year or two ago with his good advice book.
I sure will.
And he hung out with us for a nice old hour, so we really enjoyed him, and we're thrilled about the success of Air America. Please just blow kisses for us.
I will do that.
Okay?
Thanks, Marlena.
Thanks, Joe. Appreciate your time.
Bye-bye.
Okay, that was Joe Connison, author of Hunting the President, author of Big Lies, and author of The Raw Deal about Social Security. And I think what I'll do is I'll take a little musical break, and then we'll be right back. That was Louisiana legend Raful Neal, that piece titled Blues on the Moon. I'm Marlena Smith. It's the Electronic Salon. We're back for a new season. We start Pledge Drive next week, and we encourage you to look at your discretionary income, your educational and information dollars, and think about excuse me, how much you want to contribute to this little musical, this little radio station, rather, that's been here for some 40 years. I'm going to take a little wandering stroll here down the lane of things that need to be done. So just hang on and let's see what they want us to hear about the elections here at KABU.
Hi, I'm Cherie Blackfeather, and I'm running for the KABU Board of Directors. The reason that I'm running is because I think there needs to be some people on the board who are pro-technology. I think that the board has been stuck in that area. I want to see, there's a lot of creative, positive energy in the station from volunteers and staff, and I think that that is underutilized, and I think there needs to be more collaboration between the board, volunteers, and staff. And I would like to advocate for us to be much more involved with the media reform movement and very pro-technology and get some young people in here who are not afraid of the technology.
Okay, what you just heard is the beginning of a series of short statements. You'll be hearing by one or two of the 18 candidates running for KABU's Board of Directors. KABU members will be receiving a ballot in the mail. Election results will be announced at the annual membership meeting for KABU on Sunday, September 25th, 1 to 3 p.m. at Nocturnal Lounge, 1800 East Burnside. There are, as indicated, 18 candidates for the board coming up, and so we'll be promoing these speeches on each of the programs at KABU, and here's one more for you to listen to.
Ryan, I'm running for the board of directors of KBOO. All I want to say is that I believe that the respect to the rights of others is a piece that was said by Benito Juarez. I don't want to be right or force my points of views on others. I want respect for each individual point of views and work hard to achieve mutual goals. I enjoy KABU for that same reason. It's fun and professional, and all voices are heard here.
Okay, you got it. So here we are, kind of slapping the show together, trying to get things done. You heard Joe Connison. He'll be at the First Unitarian Church tonight, and that's in all the local listings. He'll have copies of the book, and he'll be there to talk. He'll probably be on Air America in just a little bit this morning if you want to catch him there. A little bit more of a mainline approach than we often take here at KABU. We're willing to go a little farther and call things as we see them much more directly. I don't really need much more evidence to have drawn the conclusions that I've drawn, that I think this was pretty much an intended event that happened in the Gulf. When you look at the structural events, when you fail to prepare for an event of this magnitude and you know they happen, when you deny the money to keep the levees safe, when other countries live with these situations, Holland, for example, Sweden, they, you know, deal with this kind of stuff. So the technology is there. We chose not to use it. When we put checkpoints around a city after this has happened and the city's filling up with water and the people are stuck inside and some 20% haven't been evacuated because they couldn't afford to be evacuated, when you leave them in there, put checkpoints around the city so they can't leave the city, that becomes a question. When supplies are available, the USS Bataan is off the coast. It has hospital beds, 100 or more hospital beds, 6 operating rooms, the capacity to make water, and that vessel is not being used, and it's right there. When you're not flying in and airlifting food and water, as soon as the event happens. These are not just bungling events as far as I'm concerned. I think it's the most embarrassing and painful thing that I've ever seen happen in this country where I happen to live and in which I was born. I think this is overt racism. I think I'm going to agree with Randy Rhodes and Mike Malloy that this may well indeed be negligent homicide. And I think I'm going to push the envelope a little bit further than my guest. And that's okay. We all get to see it in the way that we think we need to see it. But I want to go on record. I don't think that this was mere bungling and incompetence, although I think that's a huge factor. I think there are other things in play here, and I think this is, as Barbara Bush said at the Texas Dome, these are underprivileged people. This living in this dome, sleeping on cots next to each other, basically getting meals ready to eat. This must be a pretty good deal for them. That is so denigrating and so indicative of the attitudes and the arrogance of the elite who make those kinds of statements that I just can't rule out a whole lot of things that might have actually gone wrong. So that's what I wanted to say, and that's where I am on it. And by gum, I'm sticking with it. I think what I'm going to do now, we don't have a whole lot of time left, but I have a little Dave Emery on CD, and I think what I'm going to do is bring Dave Emery up because it's been a long time since we've listened to Dave Emery, and this piece is an update on neo-Nazis and white supremacists. It was recorded in August on the 7th, and somehow it just seems like a reasonable thing to be playing right now.
Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 520, titled Update on White Supremacists and Neo-Nazis, being recorded on August 7th of the year 2005. At the end of this side, I'm going to mention some online resources because there is a vast cornucopia of online resources available on the Spitfire website and on linked websites. For those listeners who only listen to the program, you're missing an awful lot of information. Certainly all of the programs are available on audio online, but there's a tremendous and ever-growing amount of printed information, and I emphatically encourage listeners to take advantage of that. I will go into that, at least to a certain extent, at the end of this side. Now, as should not be surprising for an anti-fascist researcher, I have covered over the years various white supremacist and neo-Nazi organizations and neo-fascist organizations. I don't like the term neo-Nazi because I think somehow it implies that they're less than Nazi or just, well, they're not real Nazis, they're just neo-Nazis. Hell no, they're real Nazis, and there are profound links between the old guard and the new guard. Perhaps the most significant and largely overlooked was the fact that an infiltrator or a turncoat in the Order, the Nazi terror group that, among other things, killed Alan Berg, Denver talk show host, in the 1980s, an infiltrator, or actually a turncoat named Martinez, revealed to FBI that, in fact, the Order was receiving financing from, quote, German families, unquote, in Latin America. Three guesses who that might be. There are numerous other links between the old guard and the new guard as well, but hence my distaste for the term neo-Nazi. However, it has passed into usage. We're going to begin by taking a look at an article that supplements information we saw in For the Record program number 164 about the Atlanta child murders. An African-American man named Wayne Williams was convicted in two of the killings and blamed for 22 others, but in fact there is information that suggests the distinct possibility that those killings may have been committed by white supremacists slash Ku Klux Klansmen in the Atlanta area, in part in an attempt to stir up to precipitate riots among the African-American community in Atlanta and perhaps elsewhere. Again, we went into this in For the Record 164, but information about this is now out in the Associated Press. This is an AP story by Harry R. Weber. It's headlined, Tapes May Link Georgia Killings and Supremacist. It reads in part as follows. A white supremacist investigated for a child killing spree that terrorized Atlanta's black community once praised the crimes in secretly recorded conversations obtained by the Associated Press. Although Charles T. Sanders did not claim responsibility for any of the deaths, lawyers for Wayne Williams, the black man convicted in two of the murders and blamed for 22 others between 1979 and 1981, believe the evidence will help their bid for a new trial. Sanders, whose older brother Don was a reputed officer of the Ku Klux Klan, told an informant for the Georgia Bureau of Investigation in the 1981 recording that the killer had, quote, wiped out 1,000 future generations of niggers, unquote. His only complaint was that the killings were prompting police roadblocks. Police dropped the probe into the Klan's possible involvement after 7 weeks, when Sanders and two of his brothers passed lie detector tests, according to the documents released this week to the AP following an open records request. The 315 pages of documents show the investigation started after a source told police that Sanders said the KKK, quote, was creating an uprising among the blacks, that they were killing the children, that they are going to do one each month until things blow up, unquote. The source also told police that Sanders had threatened to strangle one of the children, Luby Jeter, because Jeter ran into Sanders' car with a go-kart. Jeter was later strangled, and Williams was blamed for his death, though never charged. Williams has long contended that he was framed, and that Atlanta officials covered up evidence that the Klan was involved in the killings to avoid a race war in the city. His lawyers believe the materials released to the AP and other evidence they're seeking will help to get him a new trial. They say the investigation into the Klan was withheld from Williams' defense. Quote, there is no doubt that evidence in the hands of the defense and the jury would have at the very least created reasonable doubt at Wayne's trial, unquote, said Williams' lawyer Michael Lee Jackson. Transcripts of multiple wiretapped conversations involving the Sanders family were not released, and authorities won't say if there were any admissions in those talks. In May, the police chief in neighboring DeKalb County, who assisted with the original investigations, said he was reopening the investigation of five of the deaths. So again, that supplements information that has already been presented in For the Record program number 164. It'll be interesting to see ultimately what happens with Wayne Williams' trial. It should be noted that white supremacists and neo-Nazis, again, I don't like the term, but it's passed into usage, have infiltrated and have formed liaisons with various elements of not only police agencies, but also elements of ours and other countries' national security establishments. There are a number of different For the Record programs about that, including one called Specialized Knowledge and Abilities, a multi-part For the Record series that is available for download from the WFMU download website. More about that at the end of the broadcast. In For the Record program number 32, we took a look at the martial law contingency plans that were placed on the books by Oliver North and company in as a part of their planning for counterterrorism or for dealing with terrorist incidents or nuclear war or other disasters. Those martial law contingency plans entailed, among other things, the deputization of paramilitary right-wing groups and their empowerment as federal agents. One of the things that should be noted is that the current military is stressed to the max with the occupations of Afghanistan and Iraq. The National Guard or many members of the National Guard are out of the country. The reserves are stretched to the maximum. The head of the Army Reserves has stated in no uncertain terms that he is heading a broken force. There has been a lot of discussion on the internet and on talk show and at on bar stools of martial law and people talking about martial law, this and that. Well, one of the interesting things about that is that if, in point of fact, there were to be a crisis of sufficient magnitude to compel the imposition of martial law, there ain't enough marshals around, so to speak, to implement martial law. And therefore, the plans that were drawn up by Ollie North and company under Citizen Reagan would very well be put into effect. And basically, you'd see the Aryan Nation, some of the more reactionary elements of the militia milieu, empowered basically as federal agents. And that is a very unappetizing prospect indeed. One of the things that I would note that is that during the Third Reich's occupation of many of the countries that they conquered, the actual liquidations, the exterminations were done by various sociopaths and criminal elements in those societies. They were made official Third Reich soldiers, but for example, on the Eastern Front, the Einsatzgruppen were largely composed of gangsters, sociopaths, and other misfits, although they were made soldiers, basically, agents of the Third Reich. And in terms of realizing or speculating about how such a scenario could take place in the United States, the declaration of martial law and the realization of that part of the plans drawn up by Ollie North and company, namely the deputization of paramilitary right-wingers, might very well open the door for official funding of the elements who would conduct such liquidations. This, obviously, is a frightening scenario, hopefully one that won't take place, but yet with much of the Muslim world at this point, roused up into a state of lethal animosity towards the United States, with nuclear technology now in their hands and circulating, as well as other lethal technologies. The possibility of just such an eventuality is not one that should be too readily dismissed. And again, as discussed in numerous programs, including For the Record programs 443, 352, and 456, there are operational links between many of the current generation of Nazis and fascists and some of their Islamo-fascist colleagues, the cement, the unifying element, what I call the underground Reich. Now, in that context, we're going to take a look at the Minutemen. Now, the Minutemen were originally a paramilitary right-wing group in the late 50s and early 60s. The name has been appropriated by a paramilitary group that garnered a tremendous amount of good publicity by patrolling a portion of the Mexican-U.S. border in Arizona in order to stem the flow of illegal refugees across the U.S.-Mexican border. As we're going to see in the article that we're about to examine, the Minutemen received a lot of positive publicity. Perhaps the best element of that was when Governor Schwarzenazi, or Governor Schwarzenegger as he's generally known, endorsed the Minutemen and indicated that he thought it would be a great idea if they came to California to do the same thing. I would note in this regard that Schwarzenegger is not only a member of a group called U.S. English, originally a group that appears to have been fairly benign and aimed at promoting the development of English language skills by immigrants into the United States, but one that appears to have been co-opted by racist and chauvinistic and white supremacist elements. Schwarzenegger was also a big backer of Prop 187 that was financed in part by the Federation for American Immigration Reform, which in turn has been financed by the Pioneer Fund. The Pioneer Fund is an American eugenics organization that wielded significant influence on the Third Reich's racial laws, and it was financed in part by Wycliffe Draper, who was the cousin of the very famous Draper family, William Draper Jr., William Draper III, and Tim Draper, that not only helped to capitalize Nazi Germany, but are very close to the Bush administration and have been primary elements of the Republican establishment for some time. One of the elements of misdirection, I guess you could say, that the media indulged in was their failure to report something that really should come as no great surprise, the fact that racist, fascist, and white supremacist elements were very much present in the Minutemen milieu. And in fact, many of the organizers of this particular demonstration or exercise hold views dramatically contrary to the way they were represented by the media, who pretty much gave them a free pass. One should consider the Minuteman phenomenon and the martial law contingency plans drawn up by Ali North and company, which called for the deputization of paramilitary right-wingers, and consider the following. This is from the Online Journal. This is from the Online Journal of May 10th, 2005. The article is by Bill Berkowitz. It's titled, The Minutemen and the Media. It reads in part as follows. Members of the Minuteman Project, the armed group that patrolled a 23-mile strip of the Arizona-Mexico border through the month of April, have gone home, but they're promising to return with, quote, tens of thousands, unquote, more border volunteers in October. If they do return, they may be carrying California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's endorsement with them. Last week, the governor told a Los Angeles radio station that the Minutemen had done a terrific job and that they were welcome to come to California. During the run-up to the month-long patrol, Lou Dobbs, the host of CNN's Lou Dobbs Tonight, gave the Minutemen, quote, millions in free publicity, plugging it for weeks and turning over large segments of his airtime to directly promoting the project, unquote. Mark Cooper, a contributing editor of The Nation and a columnist for LA Weekly, told Alternet. And a May 2nd Christian Science Monitor Roundup piece on the Minuteman Project gave the group a generally favorable review while ignoring the controversial links of Minuteman Project participants to radical right-wing organizations. With dozens of television reporters on hand and satellite trucks in tow, the media swarmed the area, hunting video that might knock the Michael Jackson trial, the missing wife-to-be case, and or any boy-down-the-well stories out of the lead position on local and national newscasts.
And that's all we have time for. And, oh, my goodness, isn't it interesting? We're talking about white supremacists. We're talking about racism. And we're talking about what just happened in the southeastern United States. You don't suppose it's merely coincidental, or is it connected, or what? That's all I have to say for today. We're going to go out with a little bit of music, and I want you to stay tuned to your community radio station, because let's see what's coming up here. We got more coming up. Hang on. Lisa Loving will be right at the board after I leave.